From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the story of silent homelessness here.
Then on the week that Milwaukee was awarded the 2020 Democratic Convention, we'll consider the city's history of socialist mayors.
Plus, a soaring Carmina Burana opens tonight at Skylight Music Theater.
You get to be in it. The audience will just be able to enjoy themselves. And instead of maybe thinking so much, you get to experience. You get to feel. I think that was Orff's major intention.
And how tango evolved to become practically the national art form of Argentina.
Everybody says it started in the outskirts and maybe in the brothels, but probably so. The thing is that little by little made it into downtown. And when it arrived in Paris, then everything changed.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There has been good news in recent years when it comes to Milwaukee's chronic homelessness problem. Simply put, fewer people are trying to survive out on the streets. But as with many social issues, there's a more complicated story just beneath the surface.
Writer Barbara Miner helps tell the story of the more silent homelessness problem here in an article and photo essay in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine. One of the people she profiles is Natalie Hayden, who lived in a shelter with her daughter for 8 months recently. Miner and Hayden joined us in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mitch.
What was the story of homelessness you were trying to tell with these portraits?
Homelessness, like many social issues in Milwaukee, is pretty complicated. So when I was, talking it over with Chris, the editor at Milwaukee Magazine, and he was very good, we had a good back and forth, it was how to tell a complicated story on a pretty short timeline that really would grab people's attention. And we settled on, we really needed to tell stories, one, because it makes the issue real. And through various stories, one could approach the complexities rather than having just one person or one theme.
Well, and I think you're right that we kind of have a certain image in our minds of what homelessness often looks like, people under overpasses and bridges, standing by the on-ramps with signs, maybe a tent city. But really, it probably shouldn't be a surprise to us that the reality is more complicated than that.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we were trying to get at, because when I talked to Chris, he said, well, this is for the March issue. And I said, March. Now, little did I know then at that point that what kind of March we'd be having. But, traditionally, beginning of March, you get some sun and people are thinking of spring. And I said, Chris, people aren't going to be thinking about freezing to death under the underpass, which is a hugely important issue. But their minds will be elsewhere. And part of the purpose of the story was to remind people that homelessness is a year-round problem.
You make the point that there has been some progress made in alleviating the issue of traditional homelessness, but it's sort of the opposite when it comes to what you term the hidden homeless. Can you paint a picture of how the dynamic is changing in both of these ways?
Well, with the quote-unquote traditional homelessness, which is people who are chronically out on the streets or chronically in shelters, there's been more money going into that particular problem. And when you put money into a problem, there tend to be more solutions. The issue of homelessness, more broadly defined, is really grounded in a lot of broader social problems: racism, discrimination against LGBTQ, people with felony convictions, evictions. And these are much more complicated problems, and there hasn't yet been the push to specifically address that overall housing crisis in Milwaukee.
Is it harder to quantify?
Well, Milwaukee Public Schools actually is, the schools by federal law have to try and quantify this. And so they really have, in terms of that broader definition, if there's any reliable statistics, that's where you'll find it.
And the statistics were kind of stunning. I mean, this is not a statistics-laden story, but in an environment where it sounds like, on one hand, we're really doing something about chronic homelessness, the number of these, hidden homeless people is skyrocketing.
Definitely skyrocketing. And hidden homeless really is, I think, an appropriate term for the problem, because oftentimes people aren't seen as quote-unquote homeless in the traditional sense. They're couch surfing or they're bouncing around. But as I said, because of the federal law, the school districts, the public school districts, have to keep track. And one of the things that surprised me is not just that Milwaukee's figures have almost doubled, but this is true across the state as well.
Natalie Hayden, I gather your circumstances today are much better than when you and your daughter's situation was at its worst.
I definitely agree with you there.
When we're talking, you know, Barbara Miner and I are talking about homelessness, is it an out-of-body experience to listen to this conversation and think about when this was your life as well?
Absolutely. And I find myself in a space of reflecting more often than not. As of recently, I have spoken to many young ladies that are in the space that I once occupied, this hidden homelessness. You know, they obtained a certain level of education. They've done everything that's quote-unquote by the book, you know, gotten married, had their family, and they find themselves in this space now living in a shelter or possibly someone's couch or, like, couch hopping, and I definitely can relate to that.
It must be difficult to talk about, but at some degree, you must be at a place where you're able to, at this point, to have shared it with Barbara and the city. Can you share with us how you ended up spending the time you did at the shelter where you ended up?
You know, my time at the shelter.
This is Sojourner,
it's
right?
It's Sojourner Family Peace Center, and it has so many names for us. It's called The Hotel. It speaks so many volumes to the levels of healing that I did receive. But my time there was definitely intentionally effective to the very healing that I needed when I arrived at the doorsteps.
And you had arrived there, unfortunately, due to domestic violence, right?
That's true, yes. Unfortunately.
Yeah. What did the time there do to allow you to get your life back in to a sense of normalcy, back in order?
The disruption, the dysfunction, the uncertainty, it put me in a space that Sojourner provides for all of their guests to really just focus on themselves, the inner peace that has been crumbled, the foundation that was no longer available to them. They have to completely start from scratch. And I looked at that as an opportunity to create the foundation that I so needed. In Sojourner, they offered an array of services that I did not know was provided to the community. So I came through the doors looking for shelter, and I left receiving so many other services that added to that the space that I can now occupy now.
Services like what?
Services such as, you know, acupuncture, therapy, trauma therapy, because it's very specific. When you're in a domestic violence shelter, you've been traumatized. And at some point, you've been chronically traumatized. So, you know, there's specific therapists that are there, not just for you, but for your children. They have a wonderful children's program that allows our children to continue to be children during trauma. And that was the most settling portion for me because I had my daughter with me. And it was important that not only was she able to continue to be the child that she deserves to be, but she was able to receive healing as well along the way.
You used the term uncertainty, and I wanted to bring Barbara back in on the conversation here because I think, you know, it's easy for us to wrap our heads around the uncertainty of, you know, will I freeze to death because I'm staying under an overpass and it's 20 degrees? But it sounds like the kind of uncertainty that Natalie is talking about is maybe an even more, I guess I don't want to quantify, but it's an especially insidious kind of uncertainty. Like, how am I going to get through this?
Well, there's like the uncertainty, for example, that I've been evicted. Now what? And that's on my record, and I'm going to have trouble finding a new place. Or I just lost my job. I have enough money for next month's rent, but after that, who knows? Or, you know, my car just got towed because I forgot to move it from the alternate side or the, you know, no snow removal parking, and it's in, you know, the lot, and I don't have the money to get that car out of the lot. which means I can't go to work. So there's just all these different factors. And, you know, people think, oh, you're homeless. You must be very untogether. You must be an addict. You must have mental health issues. You must be close to nothing. And every single person that I interviewed, they were amazing people. They were complicated people. None of them were defined by their homelessness. They defined themselves as mother, father, student, who, for a lot of different reasons, at a certain point in their life, found themselves without a place to call home.
Natalie, it sounds like what got you there happened, you know, in an instant. How important was patience in the time that you spent at Sojourner?
Patience was something that was displayed to me from the moment that I entered Sojourner. So I knew that it was imperative that I was first patient with myself. I also had to be patient with my daughter. You know, it's a domino effect. Everyone's affected by it. And I knew that it was necessary that first I must be patient with myself. And that is what allowed me to allow time to run its course and patience to run its course. And patience is still running its course.
How does that time, those months you spent at Sojourner, how does it shape who you are and what you do today?
So it lets me know that I have to be extremely intentional with my time. Sojourner was so concentrated. There was so much that I had to multitask in a short amount of time. Even though in a shelter's time frame, you're technically not supposed to be there longer than a month, 2 months. But it's Sojourner's case by case.
And you were there for eight months?
8 months, yeah. Yes. And there was a lot that transpired, you know, with the courts, with my housing and employment and legal fees. And just, you know, just trying to gather myself. There were a lot of moving pieces and components that needed to align in order for me to feel comfortable enough to fly out of the nest.
Do you feel, I mean, the word peace is in Sojourner's name. Do you feel at peace at this point?
Absolutely, yes.
I would think that it would be difficult to tell this story to the world. Did you have qualms in putting yourself out there, or was it important for you to share it?
I think it's extremely important that I did share and that I continue to share. There was no reservations on putting it out there. It's necessary.
Well, I'm grateful that you did. And Barbara Miner, I'm grateful that we had a chance to, first of all, read all of these stories and spend some time with both of you in talking about them.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you.
Barbara Miner's story on hidden homelessness in Milwaukee is in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Natalie Hayden is one of the people that she profiles. She now works as a counselor with the Milwaukee Job Corps. You can find more about the story at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break now and then revisit our Bubbler Talk story on the history of socialist mayors in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee will be at the center of the political world in the summer of next year as the city hosts the Democratic National Convention. The city learned this week that it was chosen, beating out Houston and Miami.
As thousands of delegates, reporters, and other visitors prepare to descend on Milwaukee, many might be intrigued by the city's interesting political history. Milwaukee was known for its socialist mayors in the 1900s.
We're sharing part of that story today in this encore presentation of Bubbler Talk. It includes portions of an interview with Anita Zeidler, who has since passed away.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Annalise Hensel with this week's inquiry from Brad Lichtenstein.
My question is, besides the lakefront, what else did socialist mayors do for Milwaukee?
UWM historian Ames McGinnis met Lichtenstein and me at the lakefront custard stand to share the backstory.
This most precious part of the lakefront was the preserve of the richest people in the city, and you can still see some of their mansions up on the hill. Socialists said, well, we're just going to build a new lakefront into the lake.
Not only did Milwaukee socialists fill in part of the lake to create more public access, they also cleaned up city government. It had a bad reputation in the early 1900s before the socialists stepped in, according to historian John Goethe.
There was a mayor named David Rose. His nickname was All the Time Rosie. On his watch, he had prostitution, all-night saloons, gambling dens flourishing in the shadow of City Hall, literally.
Voters ushered in the new era by electing the city's first socialist mayor in 1910, Emil Seidel, who served a two-year term. The second, Dan Hone, for whom the bridge is named, was elected in 1916 and served for 24 years. Goethe says the mayors and some socialist aldermen approved programs benefiting all citizens.
Everything from public housing to public health departments. They were called the sewer socialists because they wanted to have an infrastructure that wouldn't poison people with contaminated water.
At the time, socialists made inroads elsewhere in the U.S., but Kevin Abing of the Milwaukee County Historical Society says the ideology had special appeal here.
Milwaukee was known as the machine shop of the world. There was just this huge population of mostly ethnic workers who were laboring in the factories for pennies. They definitely were interested in improving the status of the working class.
Beginning in the 1930s, interest in socialism dwindled as the Democratic Party grew more liberal and attracted labor unions and others who had backed socialists. And when voters elected Frank Zeidler in 1948, the city's third and final socialist mayor, it wasn't because of his party affiliation. His daughter Anita says he won because he had name recognition. His brother Carl was a previous Milwaukee mayor. And because Frank had built a strong record of community involvement and had broad support. Even so, she says critics tried to keep him from getting elected.
There were really ugly attacks about my dad as being a communist and wanting to take over all private business.
Anita says her father fought back by showing just how normal he was. She remembers a photo taken during the first race of the family strolling down the street.
There were six of us children. And the baby my mother was carrying and my dad was carrying, the two-year-old, that apparently said to people, this guy is not dangerous. My dad always thought that that was the photo that got him elected.
Anita says her father governed with the socialist goal to help people, provide services, and make their life better. To that end, he championed the creation of UWM and Milwaukee Public Television, expanded the downtown library and public museum, and doubled the size of the city through annexation to relieve overcrowding. Anita says she sees evidence of the socialist mayors everywhere. Yet UWM historian Ames McGinnis says many people take their legacy for granted because it's subtle.
They didn't slap their name all over the place. It just says public.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Do you have a question about our city that you've always wanted answered? Submit it online at WUWM.com and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
You can listen to other Bubbler Talk episodes at WUWM.com.
Next on the show, a collaboration between four local arts groups opens tonight. We'll hear about it when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. If Carl Orff were still living, he would probably be a gazillionaire based on the licensing fees for this song alone. It's O Fortuna from Orff's Carmina Burana. The piece consists of 25 musical sections that are no longer than 4 minutes each and are taken from medieval texts dealing with fate and the unpredictability of the human condition.
While typical productions of Carmina Burana are presented in concert form, this version, opening tonight at Skylight Music Theater, is decidedly more animated, as you might expect from a collaboration between Skylight, the Milwaukee Opera Theater, DanceWorks Performance Company, and Chanticleer Chamber Choir. We are joined in the studio by Jill Anaponicek of the Milwaukee Opera Theater and Skylight, UWM faculty member Jana Ernst, Danny Kepper from DanceWorks, and Ben Bedrosky from Chanticleer. Jill Anaponicek begins by telling the story of the project.
It started percolating as we were planning the season for Skylight Music Theater and looking through lists of projects that had been considered in the past for classical programming. And they're, like, on this list, Carmina Burana just sort of jumped up to me right in that meeting, and I said it out loud, and then all of a sudden, it felt like I could see potential for doing it, that it could bring something special to Skylight and to other collaborating organizations, and saw the possibility of working with other groups to do something really different than previous opera programming at Skylight.
And so when did all of you get involved? When did she start bringing you in on these discussions, on these production meetings?
I think I was last. It's okay. But it was
we were saving it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Save the best for last. I was sometime in the summer, I want to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they'd been working on it, I think, longer than that. But.
I think it was this time.
That feels about right. It felt snowy. Year. I think I remember snow.
Yes.
And what my memory is that I also work at Milwaukee Opera Theater, and we were really interested in working with DanceWorks again because we've been on kind of an every other year schedule for almost 10 years now of developing a piece together on a pretty regular basis. So it was sort of time to consider a DanceWorks project. And I was really hoping, like once in a while, you just know you're dying to work with a certain artist on a project. So then asking them is really scary because you put it off and you put it off because you don't want them to say no. And so Danny and I sat down, and I really, really wanted her to say yes. And I said, like, well, what about Carmina Burana? And what I remember her saying is, yes, I've been wanting to do Big Sweaty Dancing, which is
true. It's a true story.
So gross, but yes.
Big Sweaty Dancing.
But then as soon as Danny said that, like, it's like I just started to relax into the project. Like, oh, that's enough to start building all of the other pieces. And then with this project, we did... sometimes when you're putting together something large, the picture shifts as you're working on it. You know, you have one thing in mind, but by the time you get to the project, you're working with different collaborators or different people are involved. But in this case, everything that we said at that first meeting came to pass. Like, Chanclair was the choral group that we were immediately excited about working with. So those first people said yes.
Yeah, and Chanclair had collaborated with DanceWorks for Jason Powell's production of The Quest. And so that was really the only thing like this that we'd ever been involved with. But it was also at that time that Adam Kudishat, one of our singers, was in the process of getting ready for Zvadba. He was music directing that with Milwaukee Opera Theater. And he approached me during rehearsal one day and had asked, would you think being involved with Milwaukee Opera Theater and Skylight's Carmina Burana would be something you'd be interested in? And I thought, yes. I don't know how, but yeah, that was sort of what began the process for us. And then I had heard of Jelena, and you know, knew a bunch of people who were in theater in town who were like, oh yeah, she's awesome, she's like a genius. And then I met her, and she's like, oh, I thought she's a really nice genius. But
she's approachable,
as opposed to the mad kind.
Yes.
But even from the first conversation, I thought, oh, wow, I think working with a creative mind and team, like I knew I would be involved with Jelena and with Danny, I thought like, oh, yeah, this is something that we want to explore further.
I was going to say big sweaty singing to go with the big sweaty
dancing.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I have a way with words, but but really when I listen to the music, I've said this before, because music isn't first, you know, the first thing that I'm skilled in for sure. So without the same level of expertise is the way I'm listening and perceiving the music, you know, more just like someone that has only heard O Fortuna, you know, and it's sort of just in the background of your memory bank or something. But I know as soon as I started listening to the music, it just has that visceral sort of impulse, you know, and I intentionally tried not to know all kinds of details about the content of the music because then I wouldn't be able to have that same kind of just natural reaction to, like, how does my body want to move? You know, what sort of emotional palette is it? So it's been really, really great to be drawn into the process.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, the music is so iconic now.
Yes.
In a way, it is quite simple in many aspects, like harmonically, melodically. It's really repetitive. You can think about it, and it's satisfying to think about, but you also don't have to think about it to love it. You really just feel the sort of primal, whether it's primal and sort of ferocious or primal and ethereal, It connects with people on a really base level, I think.
Well, and you mentioned ethereal and also tender.
Yes.
There are a lot
so
of wonderful mm-hmm. things in there that's not O Fortuna.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I know that's the set piece, but there's so much more to it.
Music, I'll go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think one of the first things that we observed as a group, like, for instance, it's very hard to listen to Carmina Burana while driving because at any moment it's either too soft or way too loud.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, the piece itself is built out of high contrast. Yeah. Things are super high, super low, super fast, super slow, really loud, really soft, really angry, super gentle. Like, it's everything is like constantly has this complement going on. So it's just this incredibly dynamic, roiling piece. And I think that that gets to that feeling of primal.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we share across time with other.
It's very immediate.
People.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, there's no intellectual thing holding you back or saying, like you said, Ben, we have to think about this.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't any of that here.
No.
You just get to be in it.
You get to be in it. The audience will just be able to enjoy themselves. And instead of maybe thinking so much, you get to experience. You get to feel, like Ben was saying. I think that was Orff's major intention.
And the language is sometimes functioning as an instrument.
Mm. Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like
oh,
it, the yeah. language is, it does carry meaning. And we have responded to it. Our own mm-hmm. interpretations of what that text means has informed the choreography and stage pictures. But it's also sometimes just it's part of the percussion, the vowels and the consonants and the repetition.
Yeah, I hadn't specifically thought of that, but it's almost like Justin Vernon from Bon Iver when he writes songs. It's like mm-hmm. he makes up sounds and then creates words around those sounds. It's very much like this where some of the text, the literal meaning of the word is less important than the sounds that mm-hmm. are used in that in a very percussive manner. And it's so rhythmic and percussive, you really get this sort of full sense of all of this communication of energies, be they like joyful or fearful or whatever is being expressed in the stage at that moment. Yeah.
Well, and we talked about the visual. And Danny, how many dancers do you have, or the singers dancers, or they're separate? Because I know in past things where you've collaborated, mm-hmm. we've had separate.
Yep.
There have been movement specialists and there have been singers, not necessarily the same people.
Yes, there are 7 dancers that were, you know, are either Dancer's Performance Company members or guests, but mm-hmm. I think all but one are Performance Company members. But nonetheless, so there's 7 dancers, and we rehearsed a few sections that I did perceive as somewhat separate than, you know, like this stage picture, the singers are serving a different kind of purpose in this moment, you know, singing O Fortuna. Narrator isn't the right word, but that there's this sort of feeling of, we said,
they
being
create
one
like
with the
a
universe.
Solid backdrop.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
The dance.
They're the storyteller.
Yeah.
Downstairs.
And then the dance sort of pops out against that, again, in a very physical kind of visceral way. But I accomplished all of that with the dancers ahead of time so that we could be very efficient in rehearsal. And then I reserved the rest of the concert, which is a lot of it, mm-hmm. To really rehearse together. The tavern scene.
It's a big one.
They do become indistinguishable at moments.
Yes.
Yeah.
Singer from dancer.
Yeah, and that was something that I wanted to do intentionally, you know, that it would be over time you would perceive them as a whole, including the children. There's mm-hmm. five youth performers, some that have been drawn from DanceWorks. They've done DanceWorks projects before, and some have done Skylight projects before, or Milwaukee Opera Theater. So it's just been really great. And I really do think that we've achieved that goal, at least
a
goal that I have. By
yeah.
the end, oh, yeah. I don't think anyone's looking at the people on stage and thinking dancers and singers.
I'm so proud of that. I think mm-hmm. it's one of my favorite things about what happened. But we made the choice to select 4 Chanclair members who signed up for a little bit more to be on stage with us.
A little,
like an awful lot more.
So
they may have thought they were signing up for a little bit more,
and
but it turns out
we just kept throwing stuff at them. And
the large ensemble has their own unique challenges, and they're singing on about half of the big numbers.
Yeah.
And these other quartet members are on stage, and they agreed to, well, we'll memorize everything, and we'll be there for, you know, pretty much the whole month of February and March. And
but it makes us inseparable. And so we have this collaboration, and we're really not, like, there are moments when each organization sort of takes the lead, but you cannot tell the Chanclair 4 from the Skylight performers. And there are moments when we're all in the tavern, and other than when someone does an arabesque, like, you can't tell which ones are the dancers and which ones are the singers. And I love that. I love that it's not just the choir up in the gallery like, oh, that's where Chanclair is. Like, mm-hmm. they're in both places. They're on stage and in the gallery. Mm. And the dancers are in the scene work with us as well as doing total choreography.
Well, and it's going to be fantastic because when everybody is doing their thing with this, you can't help but just be sucked into it.
Absolutely.
And just go for the ride and have a great time.
It's a great show to bring kids to as well. I've been telling everybody that. It's only an hour and 10 minutes. There's no intermission. So even on a school night, it won't be that bad. And the kids, they're going to just love it. There's so much going on. It's really for everybody. It's really just wonderful.
The ORF stuff is usually, that's where you first usually get, at least I did, you know, elementary school, it was, we heard.
That's a total gateway piece.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly. It's the gateway drug into other opera. You know, you give them ORF, and the next thing you know, they're listening to
Beethoven
the Ring Cycle.
Yeah.
It's like, no, Mom, I've got to be here 19 hours and finish the Ring Cycle.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, truly it is, because it is so rhythmic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great for kids. Mm-hmm. It's melodic. Mm-hmm. It's all of the things that you want. It's theatrical.
Yeah. Oh.
I mean, it's
everything
just
is staged. There's nobody's sitting around. We're moving.
And so the piece in and of itself and its construction, it's continually shifting. It doesn't do a 20-minute exposition on on the sort of development of a theme. It always has it always has
like some composers we could name.
Yes.
It always has very distinct contrasts. And I think even beyond that, then, for this production, is that thinking visually, like, how do I say this without insulting people nowadays? Our generation that
are you talking
really
about our short attention spans?
Yeah, can't pay attention to, you know, that will scroll through news feeds and things. They won't have a hard time being completely engaged. And I actually would think if I was not involved here, if I just was in the audience, that I would feel I would need to see this production multiple times just to get everything that's happening, because there's so much sound-wise that's happening that will be happening with the percussionists and pianists, that the singers on stage, the singers from the balcony, and then to see the staging and the beautiful movement, but also the like whole body expression, mm-hmm. that especially that watching a lot of the dancers do is really breathtaking. And then along with that, to think about, you know, not just the details of what's happening, but what's being expressed, which I think is, that's been a really cool part to see this evolve, to listen to the discussions that we're having. There's a lot of meat to think about, even if you're just experiencing it and sort of taking in the immediate emotions.
Yeah, I would say all inside of this hour, there's passion, there's joy, there's incredible sorrow, and
it packs a punch.
Yeah, there's there's hilarious
stuff.
We tried
to hit the whole life cycle.
We did. Yeah, I think we did. I think people are going to leave the theater going, what was that? That was amazing. Yeah. I want to see that again. Yeah.
So the question is, will this kind of collaboration happen again amongst the four of you?
I hope so.
Yeah, I don't want to think about this one being over. Bonnie, I'm not ready.
Don't leave me. Don't ever leave me.
No, it's been really, really great. You know, just to see what can happen when you really work together, and really with no, forgive me if I missed one, but with no moments of conflict, so to speak.
No, actually, it's been almost too easy. Yeah, like, we're just all on the same page, and we're all, we've had a
We developed
Wonderful
it together.
We really
so we really
did.
Started with a blank page and created it together.
Carmina Burana opens tonight at the Cabot Theater in the Broadway Theater Center. We spoke with stage director Jill Anaponicek, music director Jana Ernst, choreographer Danny Kepper, and conductor Benjamin Bedrosky. There's more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break and then move from O Fortuna to the tango. We will hear some music played on the bandoneon when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. That is the sound of the bandoneon, a type of accordion that has no keyboard but buttons on both sides. It's an instrument that has been identified with Argentina and the music of tango. And the man playing this is one of our guests in the studio, Danielle Vanelli.
Joining him are Argentinian composer Martin Palmieri and the artistic director of Master Singers of Milwaukee, Eduardo Garcia Novelli. The Master Singers will present a concert this weekend on tango-related music, including Palmieri's Misa Tango and some music that features Benelli in a solo performance. All three of them and the bandoneon joined us in the studio this week. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
And, Danielle, we have a beautiful example of the bandoneon, which we're going to hear a little bit later. Eduardo, I want to start with what the instrument is, where it fits in to the pantheon of Argentinian music. Let's start just sort of at the beginning with that.
I will just give a short introduction because I'm not the specialist here. But in any case, the bandoneon is the what I call the quintessential tango instrument. But we can ask them a little bit to start a little bit maybe where the bandoneon is coming from. ¿De dónde viene el bandoneón?
El bandoneón is originated in Deutschland.
Germany.
In Germany, yep. Right.
Germany. In maybe 1850.
So mid of 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's an instrument, very, very small, and envelopment for 1, 2, 3, 4 years creció.
Grew up or grew, developed.
Y arribó a la Argentina.
Arrived in Argentina.
Arrived in Argentina 1900.
Around the turn of the century.
Now, did the bandoneon, was tango happening at that point, or did bandoneon precede tango?
El tango ya estaba sucediendo en ese momento. No es que el bandoneón
sucedía
lo
porque se ejecutaba con flauta, violín y guitarra.
Yeah, it was happening, and it was happening with flute, with guitar.
Y violín.
And violin.
But, pero el bandoneón reemplazó al violín y
so
a la flauta.
Bandoneón was actually replacing some of those instruments and taking a lead, really, from that point onwards.
Why was the instrument adopted into tango? I mean, what was it about it?
¿Qué había en el instrumento que fue adoptado por el tango?
Bueno, ¿qué pasaba con el instrumento? Que era la voz nostalgia del instrumento, nostálgica.
Like it's a very nostalgic sound for the...
Yeah.
And of course, that's also quintessential about tango.
La voz del inmigrante italiano.
Interesting. The voice of the immigrant. Let's remember that Argentina is a land of immigration. Especially at the turn of the century, like thousands, probably millions of Europeans came to Argentina, particularly from, say, 1880 to 1930, say that chunk of time.
Lots of Italians, lots of Germans, probably Spaniards.
Yeah.
Spanish.
Yeah.
Mostly Italian and Spanish.
Yeah.
So tango is famously known for being started, it started in the brothels. Is that true?
La pregunta es si empezó en los burdeles.
Bueno,
no.
Todos dicen que empezó en los burdeles. Sí, empezó en las casas malas, pero cuando llegó a París, ahí tomó, se desarrolló.
Everybody says that. Everybody says that it started in the outskirts and maybe in the brothels, but probably so. The thing is that little by little made it into downtown, and when it arrived in Paris, then everything changed.
Well, as it does when things arrive in Paris.
Right.
But it is such a sensual and sexual dance. It's wonderful when it's done well. And the music is so evocative, the music of tango. And Martin, I want to bring you in on this as well, that you've used this in your compositions. So it's not just a folk tradition, it's become a classical tradition as well.
Well, I have to say that my musical education was academic music, classical music, but in a moment I think for myself I am living in Buenos Aires, but I am not able to compose or to write an arrangement for tango. No? So I start to study the question. I studied with Maestro Rodolfo Mederos, a very important composer and bandoneonist in Buenos Aires. And of course, since I was also a choir conductor, in a moment I put together both experience. And the result was this mass, no? But of course, before composed the Misa Tango, I tried to take this melancholic thing, this all the flavor of the tango, playing the tango, no, with some musicians. We play in a group in Buenos Aires, and we spend a lot of time playing together. So the experience to play the tango is very important. To compose tango, if you want to compose tango, you have to play it, you know, of course. Finally, I can put together all my musical experience.
Is it fair to say that tango is the national music of Argentina?
I would say so, yeah. Though it is very strongly identified with Buenos Aires, with the capital, and also with Uruguay as well. Probably somebody from the province of Salta perhaps is not so much identified with tango, but they're more perhaps with folklore or something like that, or with, you know, with modern rock in Spanish. But yes, I would say it's national music.
And certainly internationally, when we hear tango, I think most of us think Argentina. They kind of go together.
You're right.
Yeah, they are part and parcel. I'm hoping we can hear a little bit of the bandoneon. Daniel, you've brought one.
Yeah, entonces tocamos algo.
Wonderful.
Un tango famous, el Choclo, de Ángel Villoldo, de last century, the beginning of the last century.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's
old tango. El tango in this época, en ese periodo, era muy alegre.
So it was a happy melody. At the beginning of tango, there was also that type of not so much melancholic, but like a feast. Mm-hmm. Right?
Era muy alegre porque se tocaba en los lugares alegres, en lugares de
para bailar,
de diversión.
So it was very
tango
fast.
Básicamente
it was played
es una danza.
Fast is a dance, and it was played in places where people would dance. So.
And so how has it changed? How has tango changed in the century and a half since it started?
The development of the orchestra is very important, no? Because in the beginning, in the old-fashioned tango, La Guardia Vieja, that we call...
This is La Guardia Vieja.
This is La Guardia Vieja.
Right, this is the old guard.
Yeah. Yeah.
The
yeah.
old
yeah.
guard. Mm-hmm.
This is with tunes, with happy tunes. But I think with the bandoneon, and you know that it's not only one bandoneon, but four or five. So you have a complete section of this instrument. And, of course, take a lot of the sound of the orchestra. And this is a sound with a lot of melancholy and very, very special sound, no? Very similar to the voice, human voice. Mm-hmm. And with the strings and bandoneon and piano, the sound of the tango without flute, without clarinet, that is a little bit more colorful. Mm-hmm. the sound becomes a little bit dark, no, because of this, because the strings and bandoneon is.
Yeah, the overtones and things that mm-hmm. you hear in the bandoneon mm-hmm. are wonderful. Yep. It's just there is sort of it almost.
Yeah,
vibrates in your belly,
and
you know.
The of course, as you hear, the bandoneon can play in rhythmically, but the fantastic skill of this is the expression, the long notes.
Maybe el tango. Bueno, toqué un primer tango muy rítmico. Mm-hmm. El segundo puede ser melódico, mm-hmm. y en donde el bandoneón empieza a tener un sonido.
So the first one that he played was a very rhythmical. But this can be more melodic. Slow and melodic.
Oh, bravo. Oh. That was magnificent. I love all of the diminished and other chords. It's almost jazzy.
The expression,
you know,
yeah.
The expressiveness of it is so
fabulous.
There's
a lot of similarities with jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
El jazz y el tango están hermanados.
Right.
Por épocas.
Yeah. And the difference between the two pieces we heard, you know, just shows the range of mm-hmm. this. So, Eduardo, you're from Argentina.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. you obviously grew up in this kind of music as well as European classical music. Mm-hmm. When did the idea for this concert that brought these two gentlemen here happen? I mean, how long have you been working on this one?
Well, there's a saying that if you put two conductors together, they talk about repertoire. Constantly. We're constantly looking for great pieces of music to perform, what our next program will be, what our next year will be. We've been thinking about this for more than a year now. In fact, by January of last year, we were making, you know, plans and everything. And, you know, you need to book these people with time because they're busy. And we need to make sure that they were available. But it was actually friends of mine, also conductors from Argentina, that pointed this piece out to me. I had no idea.
So you didn't know it before. I thought maybe you had.
No, yeah. No. It's interesting because, well, I've been living in the U.S. for a long time, but Martin and I actually studied with different with same teachers when we were there, but we're never classmates. So, but we have lots of friends in common. And one, two of those people pointed the piece out to me and said, oh, you should look at this piece. It's a great piece. And, well, the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. And here you are.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so have you heard any of the rehearsals yet? Have you heard?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, now we only practice with the trio. No? Tomorrow we will have the rehearsal with a complete orchestra. But the moment, well, was the first time that we were together, but we have a story in common. So Eduardo is a fantastic conductor and a student of music, no, that to understand the music. So the rehearsal was fantastic and we almost without stoppings we played the piece from the beginning till the end with no problem.
It was a very great rehearsal Tuesday night. Smooth ride. We went practically from the end to the end with, of course, comments and corrections and more about style than anything else. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Getting the flair of the music that even though I am from there, I'm not a specialist in tango. I'm learning, let me tell you. This is like a crash course on learning.
A crash master course.
For me too. Learning about tango style because that's the thing. You can learn the notes. Of course, because the notes are written there, but bringing it to life, that's what really takes a little while.
And is this, I mean, you're an adventurous programmer with the Master Singers, but is this the first time you've done something like this with them?
Absolutely.
And how are they responding to it? Are they loving it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can see that in their faces. And they fell in love from the beginning. Just learning the Kyrie of the Mass. It's like, oh, this is different. This is amazing. So, yes, they fell in love. Mm-hmm.
Forgive me if I don't say this exactly correctly, but tango es la vida, yeah? Tango is life.
I heard it's una gesta del alma.
It's a movement from the soul, I guess. It's
right.
It comes from the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from the heart and the soul, and it is it's wrapped in everything. And I want to thank all three of you. Muchas gracias por su tiempo, for your time today to share a little bit with us, and we will have all of the information about how to go see the whole Mass and hear everything on our website. But thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie, so much. I think it's a unique opportunity for the Milwaukee audiences to hear this music.
Eduardo Garcia Develli is the artistic director of Master Singers of Milwaukee. They'll present Misa Tango Saturday evening at Carthage College in Kenosha and Sunday afternoon at All Saints Cathedral in Milwaukee.
We also spoke with Martin Palmieri, the Argentinian composer of Misa Tango, and Danielle Benelli, a world-renowned bandoneon player who will perform in the concert. There are photos and more at WUWM.com. And the bandoneon wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Audrey Nowakowski and Joy Powers, assistant producer Maddie Andre, and intern Zoe Munson. We get additional support from digital producer Lauren Sigfusson and from the WUWM news team, including Susan Bentz and Taryn Powell this week.
Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Willie Porter wrote our theme music, and Michelle Maternowski is managing editor. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.